My guest today, James Aberesque, was the first Arab American to serve in the U.S. Senate, which he did from 1973 to 1979, representing South Dakota, when there were still a few decent human beings in the nation's highest electoral body, and he came to know AIPAC quite well. Before that, he served as congressional representative from South Dakota, where he was born 81 years ago last month to Christian emigres from Lebanon. During the Korean War, he served in the U.S. Navy. Afterward, received a degree in civil engineering from South Dakota School of Mines. He went on to earn an advanced degree from the University of South Dakota School of Law, and after passing the bar, began a legal practice in Rapid City. In 1980, after choosing not to run for re-election to the Senate, Aberesque founded the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, a grassroots civil rights organization, which is when I came to know him. In 1989, he wrote Advise and Dissent, Memoirs of a South Dakota and the U.S. Senate, and he is a co-author with the late Hyman Bookbinder of Through Different Eyes, Two Leading Americans, a Jew and an Arab, Debate U.S. Policy in the Middle East. 81, he is still as fierce an advocate as ever for justice, and I welcome Jim Aberesque to Takes on the World.
Oh, hi. Hi, Jeff.
Glad to have you here. Before I called you, I was giving a rundown of this year's AIPAC convention, which I describe as the biggest annual event that takes place in Washington. It goes a long way in determining whether we will have war or peace. In yesterday's Counterpunch Online, you have an article entitled, When Bibi Pointed the Gun, Your Money or Your Political Life, in which you posit that what happened when Bibi met Bambi was nothing less than a shakedown on the president by Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. Can you run that down for us?
Well, basically what happened is that Bibi Netanyahu's timing is perfect. He came over during a presidential election year to shake down the president. And in this respect, it was probably a good thing, because if Obama didn't cave in and sassed him or talked back, we probably have as a president one of those zanies on the Republican right, and that's worse than having Obama, I'd say. So in any event, that's a habit by Israeli prime ministers. They come over here during the election year, and they know they have enough clout to get the president in trouble. In this case, Bibi, who said that that Iran was such an existential threat to Israel, decided it wasn't as soon as Obama offered him some money and some weapons. So that threat faded away.
Now, the White House is denying that these weapons were offered, but it does seem that Netanyahu came away with something besides another triumph or humiliation of an American president.
Well, he wouldn't have done it for free, so there had to be some weapons or money or both offered.
Now,
the reports are that he was offered bunker buster bombs and other sophisticated weapons.
Now, I have, and you've been watching, you saw AIPAC directly over the years. There was a time, at least, when you were in the Senate, where people actually could, at least on the floor of the Senate, say some words critical of Israel. Now we have 100, since Robert Byrd passed away, every vote in the Senate on an issue when it comes to Israel is 100-0.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
And how have you seen this develop? And it has actually developed without any significant protest from critics of Israeli policy. It's like the Israel lobby issue is generally ignored, and we've been told U.S. supports Israel because of its U.S. strategic interest, because of U.S. imperialism. But it seems, when I've been able to find, Israel's been a major headache for every U.S. president. Whatever it offers for the U.S., it also provides headaches for Washington. How do you see that?
Well, that's exactly what happens. You know, this idea that it's a strategic asset to the United States is pure bollocks. You know, there's nothing to it. In fact, I remember back when I was in the Senate, I was waiting in line to testify at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about the Middle East, and ahead of me was a State Department low-level employee testifying, and Senator Jack Javits of New York asked him, first time, he said, "Tell us why, as a State Department employee, that Israel is a strategic asset to the United States." The poor guy couldn't answer. He didn't know what to say. So Javits kept, two or three different times, kept saying, tell us now, we want you to tell us why. And he never was able to answer the question. The reason is there's no answer to that. They are not a strategic asset.
It's interesting, Strobe Talbot, who was the senior editor of Time Magazine in 1981, wrote a piece in Time Magazine in which he described Israel as a strategic liability. And then 13 years later, when President Clinton wanted to appoint him as the Deputy Defense Secretary, the Israel lobby, of course, dragged out his their friends in Congress, dragged out this article, and he had to do like a inquisition recanting, in which he admitted that he was wrong back in 1981, and with Joe Biden as his shepherd, his guide, he apologized, he crawled in order for the Senate committee to approve his passage, one of the most disgusting performances of many in U.S. Senate history. Perhaps you could tell us some of your experiences when you were in the Senate, in the 6 years you served in the Senate, and how you think it's different from today.
Well, I think today it's easier to run a 30-second ad or a 60-second spot on TV, pulling somebody's statements out of context and showing them on TV as being a very nasty person when, in fact, it may not be true. So what's happened is that politicians are much more afraid now of saying anything that would get them in controversy. The minute you criticize Israel, you're in controversy because the lobby itself has plenty of followers in the Senate and in the House, of course, that are willing to attack you to prevent you from passing legislation. They have friends in the press who will write nasty stories about you, which happened to me, by the way, many times. So it's, you know, it's frightening for politicians who want to try to get reelected.
Well, before I called you in a talk I gave in Washington myself last week, I described the lobby, or what it is not a lobby anymore, but an alternative government that doesn't function in the shadows, but in plain sight, in which the U.S. Congress sees the Israeli prime minister as their leader and not the U.S. president.
Well, it's almost that bad, I tell you.
And we have these half a dozen think tanks in Washington, which all seem to be pro-Israel, and on all the talking heads that we see on Sunday morning come from one of these think tanks. This phenomenon has seemed to have grown over the years. Do you see a way of of changing it, or is it going to get worse until it gets?
It'll probably get worse, Jeff, rather before it gets better. I tell you, the U.S. media, the American media, has just become a tool of the corporations, number one, and certain lobbies, including the Israeli lobby, number two. It's just sad to see that. How many times have you read in the mainstream media how Israelis are killing Palestinians in the West Bank? And I read Mondo Weiss, which is a blog written by two American Jews who don't like what Israel does. And every day there's a killing or one or more of Palestinian civilians in the West Bank by Israel. Nothing's ever said about it in the mainstream press. It's sad.
It's true, and we read the New York Times. We have a large picture of Jewish children in Sderot in southern Israel running, hiding behind a bus to avoid some small rockets coming from Gaza. And when it was clear that this thing was the intent of the Netanyahu government was to elicit rocket attacks when they deliberately assassinated a leader of one of the Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza.
Well, yeah, that happens. They try to. In fact, the Israeli government cannot deal with Palestinian moderates. They want Palestinian radicals, which are much easier for them to deal with because they either kill them or not. You know, that's what it amounts to. Moderates, they like peaceful protesters. They can't handle that.
Well, even the nonviolent resistance in the West Bank. When the Israeli responds with violence, again, there's no condemnation from Washington.
Not at all.
You know, you mentioned the media, You had experience once with a face that's well known to all TV viewers, at least it's CNN, Wolf Blitzer, who started out with a Jerusalem Post and then worked for AIPAC. And you had experience with him, you wrote about recently.
Well, excuse me, I had to call.
Sure.
Yes, I made a tour of the Middle East as a U.S. senator, and I met with every Arab leader except Saddam Hussein in the Middle East, including the king of Saudi Arabia, the leader of the United Arab Emirates, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and I came back, and each one, and I made a speech at the National Press Club. No, the Federal Press Club, it was called then. That was for women and blacks, and in which I announced that every single one of the leaders I'd met with said they were willing to make a peace agreement with Israel, provided Israel would pull back to the 1967 borders and give back the land they had occupied prior to 67. And Wolf Blitzer was at that press conference, and he got up and asked two or three very hostile questions. Then he left, and the next day or so, in the AIPAC newsletter that he was writing for, there was a headline saying, Abaresque sold out to the Arabs. Well, you know, that was the start. They wanted to start a war with me, which they did, so I was happy to oblige. And ever since then, I've been in opposition to AIPAC and the Israeli lobby.
Most viewers watching CNN have no idea of Wolf Blitzer's history, but then you see a number of other commentators in the media and the talking heads who they ask for views, like Martin Indyk, and their background working with AIPAC or some pro-Israel organization is never mentioned. They're treated as if they are independent experts making an independent judgment without any bias. And this seems to have gotten worse. I've gone been watching the media for a number of years, and I remember when you were with the ADC, you put out a pamphlet it was just after the Lebanon War. Which showed the cartoons from mainstream American press. This is the Lebanon invasion of Israel, 1982. Cartoons from the...
No, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, you mean.
The Israeli invasion of Lebanon, 1982, in which mainstream American cartoonists were depicting Israel, comparing Israel with South Africa, with Nazi Germany. They talked about U.S. aid to Israel. The kind of cartoons you don't see today anymore. I mean, there was a window of opportunity in which the media was actually, at least the cartoonists, were taking accurate aim at Israel, Israeli policies, and today you don't see that at all.
I agree with that. That's absolutely, you don't see very much criticism at all. In fact, nobody in the press criticizes what Israel does at all. But the minute something happens the other way, if the Arabs might kill somebody, boy, it's a headline.
Well, you see this
build-up. And it ought to be. It ought to be on both sides, to be honest with you.
You see this build-up to the war in Iran, in which you find the editorial pages or the op-ed pages of the newspapers, Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, are open to Israeli warmongers, but not to people like M.J. Rosenberg, who I quoted, or Gideon Levy, or Israelis or American Jews who have experience in Washington, like Rosenberg, criticizing U.S. or Israeli policy. Is there anything comparable you've ever seen in your life experience, which is a long life experience, to this?
No, I've not. It's pretty unique, actually. It's amazing how the press has censored itself, basically, on Israel's crimes. It's self-censorship. I don't know how you deal with that.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed is, even though these papers are published back east, their columnists are syndicated. And so, like in our Ukiah here, we have the Washington Post columnist and the local paper, Ukiah Daily Journal, and other, the Post Democrat and Santa Rosa gets the New York Times columnist. So, some of them get Krauthammer, they get Tom Friedman. So, their opinions coming out of the Beltway or New York are shaping the opinions of people all over the country. I suppose in South Dakota, you look at the local newspaper and you see the same thing.
Oh, yeah. It's a Gannett paper here. And they every so often run some pro-Israeli column. Never anything the other way. In fact, they've shut me off from writing columns here. I used to send in an op-ed piece every so often. They stopped doing that.
You were probably the last, last senator, and there were some like Senator Fulbright and Natalie Stevenson III, who really challenged or criticized the lobby, or Israel rather, on the floor of the Senate. But you were also a target of a plot to kill you.
Well, that's what the FBI told me. One of my staff members at ADC, actually the Southern California staff director, Alex Oda, was killed by a bomb planted inside of his office. It blew him into two pieces. And during the investigation of who did that, the FBI called me, the Washington office of the FBI called me and told me that while they were doing the investigating, they uncovered a plot. Now, that's not a threat, but a plot on my life. He said, but you're okay now because the guy went back to Israel, the guy who was going to kill you. And it turned out, I'm confident it was Robert Manning, who's in prison in California now, for sending a letter bomb to a Jewish businessman that he was hired to take out by another, by a competitor Jewish businessman. It's an amazing thing.
But not for the murder of Alex Oda.
No. In fact, when he was extradited from Israel, which Israel never does, but they did in this case because they were embarrassed by his presence there, they allowed the extradition on the condition that he not be charged with the killing of Alex Oda, but only of the other businessman. And then his wife was in jail in Israel waiting extradition. She died of a heart attack. To my knowledge, he's still in prison in California for the murder.
Now, what's really interesting about that is that when the San Francisco police in 1992 raided the offices of the Anti-Defamation League and then got into the files of their spy, Roy Bullock, a case which I was involved in and got a settlement from, I was spied on by the ADL, they discovered in the files of Roy Bullock a floor plan to the office of Alex Oda, as well as a key to that office. Now, why? Bullock, of course, had ingratiated himself into a number of pro-Palestinian and anti-apartheid organizations because the ADL was also keeping files on anti-apartheid organizations because of Israel's close relations with South Africa. But it's interesting that this that Bullock, who had joined the ADL, excuse me, the ADC, American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, San Francisco chapter, would have been able to get this floor plan and have a key to Alex Oda's office. This is something, of course, the FBI did not follow up, and the connection that he might have had with Robert Manning, we never learned.
Well, I had not heard that about the key, but it explains one thing, how Manning got into the office and planted the bomb inside the door. So I never understood how that happened. Now that explains it.
Yeah, it might have come out in the court case had the case gone to court. One of the reasons people occasionally call and ask me how I could say what I say about Israel and the lobby on the air without being chased by the ADL is because we didn't sign a confidentiality agreement, and I talk about it on the air. But this is the kind of thing that we're dealing with, and this is just one thing that I happen to know about. At that time, they found that the ADL had spies and major spying operations going on in Atlanta and Chicago, but the names of their spies never were revealed.
Yeah, I noticed that. The other thing that if you remember, there were two members of AIPAC who were arrested for passing secret information from Larry Franklin, who was a Deputy Secretary of Defense. They were getting classified and secret information from him. They were charged, and Larry Franklin himself, the American bureaucrat, actually pled guilty to it. And then the charges were dropped against Rosen and the other guy.
Keith Weissman.
Weissman, yeah, Rosen and Weissman. I never understood how they could drop those charges when the other guy pled guilty in receiving or passing information to them, and they received it.
actually, right now, the ADL, excuse me, the AIPAC fired Rosen, who was their one of their top staff members, who once bragged to Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic that he could write a draft of a piece of legislation on a napkin and get 75 members of the Senate to sign it in an hour.
Oh, I believe that.
They fired him because they said what he did in passing on this information to a Washington Post journalist and to a member of the Israeli embassy, false piece of information, was standard practice at AIPAC. And AIPAC fired him and said this is not standard practice. And right now he has a lawsuit going against them for $20 million. And his lawyer says, well, AIPAC has no standards. That was what the AIPAC did on the Capitol Hill. And they had a whole history of getting information, classified information, and misusing it. And they have been given a free pass to do this as no other lobby has.
That's true. That's true.
You were involved with the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, a founder of it. What do you see in the Arab American community in opposition to this? It doesn't seem like, given the overwhelming odds that the Arab American community is facing, particularly since 9/11.
Well, first of all, the American Arab community does not donate money to this organization very much anyhow. So their budget is way, way below. I think the budget of AIPAC itself is around 60, 70 million a year.
Yeah.
And the American Jewish Committee, they're all comparable. There's several Jewish organizations that support Israel have tremendous big budgets. And the Arab American, when I was there, the ADC had about the maximum they ever got was about $2 million, and all by contributions. So, you know, there's just no way you can match that kind of money.
It probably is not much different today.
Well, it's less. They're getting less money today than they ever did.
And of course, you see with the political election cycle, with the super PACs, with the corporations on one side and Sheldon Adelson on the other, that it's just become a board game for the billionaires.
Well, you can't match the kind of money that these millionaires and billionaires pump into campaigns.
Of course, there's another problem. If an American, Arab, or Muslim gives money to a politician, the other side finds out about it. The politician then gets targeted.
Oh, yeah. You know, years ago when Robert Kennedy, was Joseph Kennedy, Bobby's oldest son, ran for Congress up in Massachusetts, I got a fundraising letter from him, so I scratched together a little money, about $100, and sent it to him. And about 3-4 weeks later, I got a call from his staff guy. I can't remember his name now, Rothman, I think, who said that we're going to send that money back to you. And I said, why? He said, well, Mr. Kennedy doesn't want to get involved in the Middle East in this way. I said, what do you mean this way? I didn't ask for anything. I liked the kid, and, you know, I supported the Kennedys all through my career. And why wouldn't I send them money? Well, they sent it back, and I called a press conference. So, and, you know, later on, Joseph Kennedy appeared at the ADC convention and apologized for sending the money back.
We just had the other day, Debbie Wasserman Schultz was supposed to speak at a Muslim event in Florida, and the publicity got out, and she canceled.
No kidding. Why was that?
The fear it's the equivalent of red baiting that we saw in the 40s, except it's more widespread, and because of the internet, it's instantaneous. And politicians simply run scared. The Democratic Party has always run scared. They run scared when it comes to military spending. They run scared on this issue.
I'm afraid that's true, yeah.
And, of course, we see President Obama, who has done more militarily in terms of arms spending for spending arms gifts to Israel than any president before him, is still being called a Muslim in Christian, so-called Christian circles, evangelical circles.
I saw the poll numbers down in Alabama and Mississippi yesterday, where they said the majority of Republicans in both Alabama and Mississippi believe he's a Muslim, which I don't believe. I mean, I can't believe that people are that ignorant.
Well, H.L. Mencken once said, "You nobody ever went broke, ever underestimated the intelligence of the American people." And around the world, they must be watching the political campaign with horror.
I hope they are,
shutting it off. You know, we go back and to Washington, and I've been there the last 2 years outside of the AIPAC convention, and the triumphalism of these conventions, where each one gets bigger and bigger, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, 10,000, 11,000, this year 13,000, someone said 14,000. They're like Nuremberg rallies in the triumphalism. There's nothing I've seen like it, and I don't think Washington ever sees anything like it. And that with two-thirds of the members of Congress now show up. It used to be only half the members of Congress. And for the first time, an American president and Secretary of Defense show up to pay homage to the Israeli foreign prime minister. And the newspapers afterward, even after Obama makes his speech, say it's up to Obama to gain the trust of Israel and Netanyahu.
Good God. No, that's really frightening, honest to God.
And yet there's no outrage.
I know. Well, the press doesn't show outrage, which that's where people get their information from, is the press. You don't see it there.
Well, we have a call coming in. Let's see who's on the air. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Averest, I have two questions. One is, what is your sense of the percentage of the Congress that actually is ideologically in the Israeli camp versus the percentage that are just intimidated or frightened of the power of the lobby?
And then the second question is... Well, let me do the first one, otherwise I'll forget it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, remember, I'm 81 years old.
Okay.
I'd say I wouldn't know the exact number, but a large percentage of them do not like AIPAC or Israel, but they're afraid of them. And I've seen that in action when I was in the Senate. People would talk in the cloakroom about how bad the pressure was from Israel and its lobby. And they'd get out on the Senate floor and just make wonderful, glowing speeches about how they loved Israel. So go ahead, the next question.
Okay, so your sense is the majority
are
actually intimidated?
Yes, I'd say so.
Okay, then the next question is, the recent surveys that I've seen from the Pew Research Center in terms of international attitudes, the vast majority of Europeans, as well as almost everyone in the Middle East, considers the U.S. and Israel to be the number one threat to world peace. And those polls have been consistent for the past 10 years or so. Where the hell is the international community in terms of pressuring the U.S. and Israel to tamp down their aggressiveness in the Middle East? Why are the rest of the world so silent while all this is going on? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Sure. Well, we're the U.S. is the big boy in the block, and we intimidate everybody else in that regard. I'm just sure that European governments would love to say something critical of Israel, but we don't allow them to do it because we hold the whip hand. We've got the money. Well, it's on credit, too, now, but we've got the money, the political power, and the military power. So who's going to go against us in that regard? The only ones, I guess, are China and Russia, which doesn't please me a lot, but at least there's somebody speaking frankly about that.
Thanks for that call. Here we have a couple more callers. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thank you for the good work that you've done in starting organizations to counter the AIPAC influence. My question is, how can AIPAC be stopped? Do you think that ending campaign funding and having only public financing of campaigns would be one way to do it? Or how can it be done? We have to stop them.
We'll try that once.
Absolutely. The best thing would be to have public financing and put an end to all private financing of political campaigns. That would do more than stop AIPAC. It would stop the corporations from raping the American public. It would just stop an awful lot of evil things. So I would like to see public finance. In fact, excuse me, the first caucus I attended when I became when I came into the Senate was I introduced a resolution calling for public financing of all campaigns. The only thing that survived that was the presidential campaign, and that's been thrown aside because Obama and the Republicans can raise a lot more than the public financing would give them.
So do you think that maybe instituting a national referendum so that the people, the 99%, could speak and call for
that? There is no such thing as a national referendum. I even tried to introduce that one time and lost that.
What happened?
Well, just lost. Nobody would. I couldn't get it through committee. But I had a big movement on trying to get that passed. Because we have it here, as you do in California. We have initiative and referendum, and it's done some pretty good work here.
Right.
I understand in California the results have not been so hot with regard to taxes, but still it's a democratic test. For democracy, it's the best thing.
Well, here the corporations have kind of taken it over, but one of the problems, of course, in getting campaign financing, any kind of change, is that the foxes are the ones who are voting for it.
Well, yeah, exactly.
This is how
the debate, when I introduced my resolution in the Democratic caucus, the debate went like this. The old committee chairman, Democrats, said, I'm not going to vote something that will give money to my opponent when he can't raise money now. Why should I do that? Well, that was the answer. That's why they didn't pass a congressional public financing. Now, the other thing to do is require Israel to register as a foreign agent, AIPAC, to register as a foreign agent, because that's what they are. But they won't do it. Nobody makes them do it.
Yes, Grant Smith of Institute for Research in Middle East Policy has been trying to do that, filed a 370-page brief with the Foreign Agent Registration Act 2 years ago and got no response. Another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, this is Bodie here. Just wanted to make a comment. It feels like the media runs everything. I mean, if we allow them all the waves on the radio and on the TV, it seems like they own the show then. Your comment, I'll take it off the air.
Well, I don't know what he means by that.
Well, he was talking about the media running things, but it's who's behind the media, not the the problem.
What the media omits is worse than what they print. They omit too many criminal acts by corporations, by the Israeli government, by other people. You know, I mean, they just omit it, and mostly because the media is owned by corporations. Why would they? You know.
Well, it's interesting, and they omit some of the important things that, quite aside from the Middle East, it's their general coverage. In your book, Advise and Dissent, which you wrote back in 1989, you have some moving passages and critical passages about your time in the Senate when there are kind of very different people there. You have Stuart Symington breaking down and having to tell his grandchildren about the...
Well, his words, Jeff, were, I don't want to tell them that America is the bully of the world. And that's the other thing that's good. You know, why don't the other countries stand up to us? We have bullied a lot of people. Our government has. You know, we've gone to Iraq when we shouldn't have. We're trying to bully Iran now. My God, it's just we've got an empire we're trying to build and maintain, and that's our problem now. That's where the money goes, and that's where our popularity went. We used to be a popular nation in the world.
We have one more caller. Hello, make it quick.
Good morning.
You're on your air. Yes.
Quickly, I would like your reaction to the existence of NPR and its negative influence on those of us who are looking for the truth. Thank you, sir.
Well, I don't listen to a lot of NPR, so I can't tell you what their negative influence is. The only thing I can tell you recently, the South Dakota Public Radio asked me to talk about the Indian Child Welfare Act, which I was the author of that when I was in the Senate. And they're having a big hullabaloo out here in other parts of the country about allowing Indian tribes to retain their own people instead of white social welfare workers, taking Indian children out of their homes and putting them with white families. And that's what the Child Welfare Act was intended to stop. Now there's a big hullabaloo about that. So that's the most recent thing I've seen on NPR.
Jim, we're coming down to the end of the hour. Any last comment for our listeners?
Well, I don't. I do seem to see your listeners are pretty up on the issues, and that's a good thing. You must keep them well informed.
We try to here. This is not occupied territory, as I've as I've said a number of times. Having been to other places like San Francisco, Berkeley, Oakland, I know what occupied territory looks like. Unfortunately, Mendocino County is not occupied territory.
I was going to say, where are you located, in Mendocino County?
Yeah, we're stationed in Philo, but we go from the inland to the coast, and so we have several little call numbers.
Well, I used to live in Mill Valley when I got out of engineering school.
Oh, well, that's...
And I worked in the city as a highway engineer.
I never knew that. Well, anyway, you're still doing it in Rapid City, South Dakota, and really appreciate you for everything you've done, Jim, and for being our guest today on Takes on the World.
My thanks to you, Jeff.
Take care. Bye-bye.